Hi, I'm J.R. Ross, editor of WISP Politics and State Affairs. We collaborated with Wisconsin I on a series of interviews with candidates for governor to ask their views on issues such as education, healthcare, economic development, and other issues that we hope to inform your vote. These interviews we posted online, both at Wisconsin I and WISP Politics. You can watch these and other campaign coverage, as well as read in-depth coverage of the 2026 campaign cycle. The primary election is Tuesday, August 11th, and thanks for watching.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. Democratic governor candidates make their final pitches ahead of Tuesday's primary. And final campaign finance numbers show Tom Tiffany has a huge advantage. Plus, Francesca Hong and David Crowley take different lessons from another state's election results. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for August 7th.
I'm Ani VanWagtendonk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Welcome to Rewind. We have been talking about this primary for months and months and months, and it is now around the corner. So let's kind of look towards Tuesday. We, you know, are seeing the candidates kind of give their final pitches. We saw Francesca Hong do a rally over the weekend with Ilhan Omar, Hassan Piker. David Crowley and Governor Evers have kind of been out on the road together. What have you been hearing from these sort of final messages that they're sending out?
Is there a path to stop Francesca Hong from becoming the nominee? And let's be honest, that's what the whole thing with Governor Evers and David Crowley is about, is stopping Francesca Hong, because they fear if she's the nominee, it's going to hurt the Democratic Party up and on the ticket in November. So what's interesting to me is Crowley's campaign put out a memo, internal memo, quote unquote, that somehow got out to a lot of reporters talking about where they see things. And their own polling had them down 18 points. Not a great sign for what's happening going to Tuesday. However, you have to look at Tuesday in Michigan, this past Tuesday, where the progressive candidate was up by double digits in the polls and won by a single point. So is there something happening here? We've talked before, polling in Wisconsin is difficult as it is. Primary is even that much more difficult. Is there something off about the public polling? Maybe. Then you dive down to some more numbers. I looked just this morning, absentee ballots. There's not a surge of them compared to 2022. We're actually kind of behind where we were 4 years ago for absentee ballots returned. So if there's a surge of new voters for Hong, how are they voting, right? They're not voting absentee, at least we don't think so far. And then the Crowley campaign argues that the electorate so far is older than what the polling shows. A lot more people 65 or older. They gravitate more toward a Crowley than a Hong. Now, I'm giving all the Crowley arguments. They're trying to make a case that there's a path. All the Democratic operatives I've talked to the past week aren't sure there is one. It's very narrow if it is there for Crowley. They are bracing for Francesca Hong to be the nominee, and Republicans nationally are almost gleeful about Hong the nominee. And just look at Fox News. They're talking about her constantly, and like her tweets about canceling Thanksgiving and proximity to whiteness and go on down the line, because they see her as the new face of the Democratic Party nationally to paint the entire party as out of touch with the average voter.
Yeah, I think the Michigan results, a lot of people are kind of looking to those for these tea leaves. And as you say, the DSA-backed candidate did squeak out a win, but really squeaked out. I mean, they didn't even call it right away. And so it's really interesting seeing the two campaigns to kind of try to message that, where there's been this question about whether these kind of upstart progressive candidates can win. The Hong campaign can point to that and say, yes, they can. And then the Crowley campaign came out and said, this gives us hope because it shows that there is actually maybe a less vocal group of people who are backing more moderate or more traditional kind of candidates, but they're out there, and so that's what we're looking to see.
But a difference between Michigan and us is that was a two-way race. We have actually a seven-way race. I mean, not officially, right? Missy Hughes dropped out June 22nd, probably dropped out, got back in. Then, you know, Sarah Rodriguez, but they're also on the ballot, and these absentee ballots have come in. So when Mandela dropped out last week, I think the day after, I counted like 140,000 absentee ballots already in, 150,000. There are Mandela Barnes votes in that batch of ballots, like Sarah Rodriguez votes in that batch. How does that complicate the path to like winning for Crowley It's really a different situation than Michigan.
Yeah, and one of the things from the polling that came out was trying to look at, for example, where the Barnes voters would then split to, and a number of them didn't even kind of list second place candidates. So I think that's another dynamic here is that you have a lot of undecided voters, and then you had a lot of people who sort of made their choice and then don't know sort of what to do after that. And so, yeah, this has been one of the weirder, I think, election cycles any of us have covered. Let's take a look at some of the final fundraising numbers that came out this week. So this is just looking at the period for July. David Crowley, really interestingly, kind of coming out with almost twice of what Hong had. And this is, of course, after he ended his race with like a third of what he got in all of July. He raised a third of that in his entire first kind of run at a campaign. They are kind of obviously in the lead. And then, of course, Tom Tiffany kind of running away with the game. But talk about some of your kind of takeaways from these reports.
So there also are called late contribution reports. So if once a reporting period closes, there's a two-week window between that and the election, you have to file a report within 72 hours of any donation of $1,000 or more. Looking at those, Crowley continues to outraise Fran 2-1. Business interest, union PACs are giving him money, saying he has solid his report. Fran's starting to get a couple of like big out-of-state donors on those late contributions. Brennan and Roy's just not catching fire. And look, Tom Tiffany is benefiting from the state GOP. He has raised more than $13 million in this calendar year from January 1st through July 27th, it was. Of that $13.3 million, $10.2 was transfers from the state GOP, which is getting almost all of its money from Dick Uihlein, Liz Uihlein, Diane Hendricks. Like, they are benefiting from the playbook they created more than a decade ago, Republicans did, to allow unlimited contributions to parties, limited transfers to candidates. Democrats have like perfected that playbook for the last 6 years, basically. Now Republicans are the ones who are like really benefiting from it, in part because the Democrats don't have a nominee, right? As long as the field is fractured, we're not sure who's going to be the nominee. They're not going to see a rush of money come in. The second thing about Francesca Hong is, like, if she's a nominee, she needs help financially, message-wise, structurally. She's raising okay money, but and has a lot of donors. But a lot of donors sometimes need to have also some big checks in there. She's not getting big checks. That's a warning sign for her of like, okay, if she's a nominee, where's the money going to come from to fund a statewide campaign that probably going to cost $50 million on each side? Like, that's the reality of what politics are like these days.
Yeah, one of the kind of other interesting discrepancies, I think, between her and David Crowley is that he got many fewer donations, but with much more money. He got these big checks from unions, for example. She got a ton more individual donations. I think it was like five or six times the number of individual donations.
It was almost 6,980-some.
But who is counting? And so, you know, again, there's no question that she has a lot of just individual excitement behind her, but to your point, what does that actually translate to in terms of how you can run a general election? And the question of, again, the sort of unions, these big organizations and how they back them, you know, we're going to be looking ahead to what the party apparatus is, what they sort of throw in if she becomes the general election candidate, because there's so much nervousness around her. Does the Democratic Party just sort of say, like, well, better her than Tom Tiffany and throw everything at it? Or are they going to be careful? And that's sort of one of the big questions.
So I don't want to talk like she is the nominee for sure. There's always a path for somebody else. Elections are surprising sometimes. But if she is, then the first thing she has to have is the Democratic Governors Association to spend money immediately on her behalf. 4 years ago, Mandela Barnes won the Democrat nomination for U.S. Senate. National Democrats abandoned him for the most part for like the first month after that primary. That's when Ron Johnson and his allies defined Mandela Barnes as soft on crime, want to abolish ICE. Now ICE is a different entity than it was 4 years ago, the whole thing. But it really put him in a hole, Mandela. He couldn't really climb out of. Now he lost by 1 point. You can Monday morning quarterback all you want, but if the Democrats had spent right away in August of 22, might they have beaten Ron Johnson? Maybe. But they've learned the lesson of they can't go dark or leave Francesca Hong or anybody alone for a month after primary and expect to win.
Well, and you've made the point, too, that another interesting kind of financial piece about the Hong campaign is that she has spent no money on television ads, which is just sort of unheard of. And so she's getting a ton of organic attention and just sort of earned media for better or for worse, you know, whether it's responding to the tweets or whatever. But that's also, I think, kind of a, she doesn't need big dollars in this primary the way some of the other candidates do. But that'll probably change, again, if she reaches the general level, because it's just a completely different ballgame.
Tom Tiffany has spent $7 million on TV already, and it's not even mid-August yet. Now, going through Fran's report, you can separate out what's a media-related expense. And I mean, anything that said media on, I grabbed it. Printing, postage, whatever. $300,000. $150,000 of that went to, like, online ads. That is unheard of. That isn't even like an assembly race these days, right? But she has all this amazing energy among these, like, supporters in the base who are turning out for her, or we think are turning out for her, definitely are supporting the polling that we're seeing. But how do you communicate to the average voter who's, like, a swing voter? Like, they're not ones who are paying attention to Rewind, though they should. They're not the ones who are on Twitter all day long. They aren't. They're going about their lives, like, right?
Sounds nice.
Yeah, it'd be great. You have to reach them through TV or through direct mail or through, like, some medium that they're on. And granted, the media landscape is fractured. You know, you watch at home for your service, but it's not like everybody has an antenna anymore and gets NBC, CBS, and ABC. Like, that's the only three options you have. You have to communicate to them somehow, though, and she's not doing it so far, but it's still working for her. It probably doesn't work in a general election, though. That is a challenge for her.
Yeah. Before we jump into, I think, some of the committee and the mega donor and the more granular stuff about Tom Tiffany, I did just want to point to a couple interesting things about the candidates who are no longer in the race that we saw in these reports. So one is just that Mandela Barnes had very little money in the bank left over. He had $125,000, a little bit less right before he ended his bid. So again, sort of writing on the wall a little bit there. And then there was this really kind of interesting situation with Sarah Rodriguez that we're going to talk about more later in the show, where she appears to have maybe mixed a supportive group with her own campaign. And again, it just kind of speaks to the complete chaos, I think, that was going on in that campaign. So we'll come back to that in a little bit. But let's talk a little bit more. You talked about the U-lines and how essentially three people are just funding the entire Republican race this year. So that's Liz and Dick Uihlein and then Diane Hendricks, who have given, gosh, where are my figures? The Uihlein's have given a combined $5 million to the GOP. I'm sure you have the Hendricks numbers off the top of your head, perhaps. but most of the money that is going to the Republican Party that can then do these pass-through contributions is coming from three people.
Look, Liz Uihlein has given $13.7 million to, like, all the committees combined. Since January 1st, just since January 1st. Now, that's only state races. She's also funding a PAC in the 7th Congressional District, which her husband's doing a PAC for the other, it's a long story. But anyway, this is perfectly legal. What's been interesting is for the last 6 years, Republicans have bemoaned out-of-state billionaires, giving them to Democrats, and then transferring to state Supreme Court races and to Tony Evers, and that getting outspent. The shoe's back on the other foot. That's kind of the thing here. My question has been, why? And asking some Republicans this week, the response that I got was, one, there's a path to win, and donor people around the party have convinced the Uihlein's, hey, it's worth investing in the state party. Now, the Uihlein's also have a summer home up in the Southern Congressional District. They're big Tiffany fans because he was a congressman up there, so that, there's a connection there as well. Also, somebody said Diane's tired of losing, so they're opening the checkbook up to try and make this happen. It's not the state GOP. Although, side note, in the pre-primary period, besides the big checks and Uihlein's, they had three individual donors. The entire four-week period, three donors. That is kind of eye-opening. That tells you how reliant they are on these big checks. Now, Republicans on the campaign committee, they had like $14.5 million in the bank. At the close of the pre-primary period, that is unheard of for a caucus fueled by big checks. Now, they're also a great operation besides the Uihlein's and Hendricks, but they're benefiting from that. The committee elected Republican Senate also, now they had a really light period this one, but they got their big check before from Diane Hendricks and Liz Uihlein, so they're doing quite well. It's a great environment for Democrats right now because of Donald Trump. The mitigating factors for Republicans are candidate quality, so Francesca Hong, and two, money. If you go nationally, the DNC is broke, the RNC is not. So up and down the races, Republicans have more money, and this gives them an opportunity, plus nationally the maps and everything else, to kind of like buck the trend of, you know, power and part in the White House doing badly in a midterm election.
Yeah, just to kind of look at some of those lopsided numbers. So $10.6 million that the Republican Assembly Campaign Committee has raised this year, Committee to Elect a Republican Senate, is $5.1 million. Compare that to $3.4 million and $3.2 million for the Democratic counterparts. But to your point, I think once we enter the general race, we will be seeing a lot of those out-of-state Democratic mega donors getting involved, because Wisconsin races are just constantly so under scrutiny, both the governor's race and then also, obviously, Democrats are hoping to flip these legislatures. And so I think that's when we'll start seeing some of those big checks getting written, is once we're past this primary.
Yeah.
There's some other races going on. Speaking of legislative races, let's talk about some of the down ballots. Let's start in the Senate. You picked out kind of two really interesting districts, the 1st and the 25th.
So the first is Andre Jock's seat. So he's retiring. Four-way primary. Drama galore in this race. So Barb Bittner is a former Calumet County chair. She sent a cease and desist letter to Ron Tusser, state lawmaker, because he texted a radio host saying that she was living with another man's wife. Okay. Then we have Bainey, who is a Gen Z mom, worked in D.C. for Ron Johnson and Paul Ryan. Great kind of profile that fit for a GOP caucus that we could use some youth, you know. But she's tied to John Gard, who's a former assembly speaker, now lobbyist for the road building industry. A group kind of connected to him is like doing ads for Bainey, which sends off like the far right into a tizzy because it's John Gard, and you know, John Gard's not a good person in their mind, that kind of thing. Then you have Andre Jacques, who his aide, Nick Revillian, is like one of the leading candidates. Now, Andre originally put out a post on Facebook saying that both Barb and Nick were good people. Then he like followed up with another post saying, well, I'm behind Nick. He also referenced rumors going around the district. Well, what he's referencing is there's been this thought in the Capitol that if Nick gets elected, that he's going to hire Andre to work in the district for him. So it's just like total drama. Whoever wins the primary is going to be the new state senator from the 1st Senate district, but just a ton of stuff going on the surface that we're not really seeing down here in Madison.
And then in the assembly, kind of similar dynamics on the Democratic side, where there's, again, I think this fight for like the soul of the Democratic Party and who's allowed in the Big Ten. And so I think you're seeing that in some of these primaries in the Milwaukee area, where, as you say, same dynamic. It's going to be a Democrat no matter who. It's the outcome of the primary is sort of the outcome of the race. And so a couple of the assembly people who have been kind of, I guess we'll talk about Sylvia, but a couple of the Democrats that have been kind of in trouble a little bit with their caucus, including Russell Goodwin, are facing these primary challengers.
So the 8th and 9th are really intertwined. So in the 8th, Sylvia Ortiz-Velez left the caucus after several months said she threatened to shoot them. There's also this fallout about resolutions honoring Hispanic veterans and Hispanic Heritage Month. So Priscilla Prado's in the 9th. She's backing the person challenging Sylvia in the 8th. Sylvia is backing the person challenging Priscilla in the 9th. And so I get the impression from my phone calls that Sylvia is maybe in more trouble because there's a concerted effort. Now, this is the lowest turnout district in the state. There were fewer than 1,800 votes cast in primary 2 years ago. Go next door to the 7th Assembly District, there were like 6,000, and the person wasn't opposed for an open seat. Okay, it gives you an idea like what's going on. Super low turnout. It's all about doors and who can do the doors. In the 9th, same dynamic, but it's more like Mimi Riza, who's the Milwaukee school board member, is running against Priscilla. There's not any like effort helping her from outside groups, so people think, well, it's more of a personal grudge kind of thing. Again, more drama, interpersonal stuff. In the 12th, with Russell Goodwin, he voted for a GOP-authored bill to ban transgender athletes from girls and women's sports. Because of that, Fair Wisconsin is spending money against him. This person was recruited, Ryan Clancy, who's got one child is transgender, is basically backing this guy who's running against Russell, says that Russell's a corporate Democrat, basically a Republican. Again, more inner caucus drama. Then the 19th, you've got Ryan Clancy, who was challenged 2 years ago. Groups went all out to beat him because of his comments about the conflict between Palestine and Israel. He beat that back easily. Bridget Maniaki, who is a former Madison alderwoman, is running against him, now lives in Milwaukee. There's no money being spent on her behalf by outside groups. Kind of tells you what's happening in that primary, so he should be okay.
And then sort of similar dynamics again in the assembly on the Republican side of things. One that you've picked out is Representative Mark Bourne's district. He's obviously one of the co-chairs of the Joint Finance Committee. That's the 37th.
This one's going to be fascinating. So in the 74th, Chance Green, both are rematches. Chance Green, the guy he beat 2 years ago, has been running basically ever since. That one, you know, strange things happen, so we'll see. The 37 will be interesting because Mark won by 40 points 2 years ago. It's the same guy. The difference is the Beaver Dam data center. And he's making, this opponent is making Mark the face of the data center. Now, I'm not sure how successful he's being to do with that, but this could be a real gauge of how effective the data center issue is for Republicans. We know about Democrats. We see the Marquette poll, you know, independents as well. But actual voting on an issue, like a kind of a single issue, this could be a good gauge of like how potent that is among Republicans.
And then the 74th.
Yeah, Chance Green. So rematch and talking to people, it's like, they always go, I think he's going to be okay. But, you know, you just never know in these rematches and the fact this guy's been running. And the guy running is kind of like part of that, the Madison's a swamp type wing of the party. And so, like, you know, Chance has been overtaken by Madison and yada, yada, yada. So that kind of thing.
That brings us to the stock report rising. We talked about this a little bit, but these GOP committees.
Yeah, so look, they're flush with cash. It's all from the Ulines and Hendricks. It is amazing what's going on right now that they're pumping all this money into these campaigns. My question is there any option or availability for Democrats to make that a weakness somehow? So remember Elon Musk, go back to the 2025 Supreme Court race. He pumped in tens of millions of dollars in Wisconsin, but he became the face of the race in some ways where Susan Crawford allies made him an issue, a referendum on Elon Musk. I mean, Brad Schimmel wrapped his arms around Elon Musk, did like a call with him. Elon did a rally in Green Bay. Elon drove the Democratic base crazy. Now, I don't think the Ulines or Dan Hendricks are household names like the founder of Tesla, who's the world's only trillionaire, last time I checked. But if you're a Democrat, what else do you do? Like, you've got another choice. And oh, by the way, this is all happening too while Ben Wickler has left state party chair for Democrats. Democrats taken over. They're not quite raising money the way they were before. Now, is that because, again, they've got a split primary for governor, or has Devin dropped off or whatnot? But there's party's not doing as well on the Democratic side. The caucuses aren't as flush with cash. So can they make a case post-primary of, hey, look what's going on, we need help? That's going to be a big challenge for them.
Speaking of drama, mixed this week is Michelle Skinner and Mike Roberts.
So, look, we've seen stories in the last week. Michelle Skinner, she ran for the Assembly 2 years ago, got knocked because she's an Eau Claire County board member, but she was driving around the district in a campaign car with Georgia license plates on it. New story from Journal Sentinel has that she claimed a lottery gaming credit in Wisconsin, while her husband claimed one for a credit in Georgia. On a lake house there. They're raising questions if this is legal, she should drop out of the race because all kinds of things are, you know, not happening here. She says, no, 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 I'm a resident here, he's a resident there. I've been married for more than 20 years, I'm not quite sure what point my marriage will become a resident of a different state than my wife, but that's besides the point. Either way, there's an issue there. Mike Roberts, Republicans love this guy as a recruit, healthcare professional, small business owner, working hard. Milwaukee Courier reported that he had some issues with like being delinquent on some things and unemployment tax or something like that. So just business things and some bookkeeping stuff. He's pushed back on that. Now, they both have answers for like what's going on. These are tailor-made hits for mail pieces and TV and radio ads for the fall. My question is, back to Francesca Hong, does Hong as the nominee widen the path for Republicans in these four Senate seats? So look at the four Senate seats. Mike Roberts is one of the toughest one for Republicans. Robin Vining is a sitting member of the Assembly, a Democrat from Wauwatosa. Joe Hendrick is a longtime GOP registering consultant. He wrote on Twitter this week that in the past 40 years, anytime a sitting rep has run for an open Senate seat, they've won except for four times. Twice, it was that they lost in a primary. Twice, they lost in a special election. So that, number one, is a problem. Number two, Kamala Harris took more votes than Donald Trump by 6 points in that seat in 2024. In a bad year for Democrats, this should be a good year for Democrats. Unless Francesca Hong is a nominee and drags down the entire ticket, then what happens? Michelle Skinner, again, flawed candidate in some ways. She had problems in 2 years ago, this stuff coming up. Jeff Smith is more liberal than his district in the Eau Claire area. That's, even Democrats will tell you that. He's the only pickup opportunity Republicans have this cycle. What does Jeff do if Fran's the nominee? Does he embrace Fran, which could alienate swing voters, or try and distance himself from Fran, which could alienate base voters? Like, right, tough for a swing seat. Other two ways to watch, Howard Markline, Republican, and then Spring Green. open 21st district, which is where Van Wongard represented, really a true swing seat. All four of those seats, Harris took more votes than Trump in 2024, and again, a bad year for Democrats. So 3 months ago, across the board, I was like, yeah, the Senate's going to flip to Democrats. There were a couple opt-ins from Republicans. Yeah, I'm not going to dismiss them, but for the most part, it was like, hey, this is tough. Now, it's a much different discussion. Like, now they're going, hey, we feel pretty good because these three swing seats, Fran's the nominee, we've got a real shot here. And man, even Mike could win in that plus six Harris seat, so we'll see. But it illustrates, again, adding the money piece, candidate quality, those are real things that kind of drive things, even a bad environment for Republicans.
And speaking of that sort of dysfunctional Democratic system falling is Sarah Rodriguez. Again, these finance reports indicating that she had to reimburse a 501c4 $52,000, also gave her own campaign $20,000 after she ended it.
And still owed more than $200,000 when you take into account like what she had for cash in hand. So a 501c4 is organized under the Internal Revenue Service Code as an issue advocacy group. I put air quotes because really it's a political organization, but they're doing ads that say nice things about you. So this group, Wisconsin Forward, Future Forward, something like that.
Future Fund.
Thank you. Wisconsin
Forward
Future
Fund.
Forward Fund. did these ads, 900 grand plus, praising Sarah for her background as a nurse, and she flipped a district or Republican district and joined Tony Evers and all these kind of things. We don't know where it gets this money from. That's one of the perks of being a 501c4. You can kind of hide those things for a while. But you're also not supposed to mingle funds from a 501c4 with a campaign. There's no way that should happen. Like, it's not, I've talked to a number of lawyers and they'll go, we don't know how you can possibly do that. That is not supposed to happen. So
someone on background told me this is the craziest thing I've ever seen.
That's something I was told by many people. Now, the theory is that somehow somebody on Sarah's campaign had access to both accounts. That would be a major no-no. Now, no offense, our Ethics Commission is not really great at going after improprieties with campaign finance reports, but when you bring in a 501c4, you're talking the IRS. Some would argue they're not very efficient or aggressive either sometimes, but you're talking federal issues. Oh, and any prosecutor in Wisconsin could open up an investigation. Sarah's campaign is based in Waukesha County. That's not a blue county, right? Eric Toney is calling on Josh Call to open up an investigation. There's some real problems there. I'm not trying to make light of it. Like, she is personally responsible for something going on here, at least financially. How's she going to pay her bills, right? Now, legally, I don't know who's at risk of being in real trouble. You would think her former campaign manager, who she's blaming it on, would be in a pickle, to say the least. But there's some real problems here with that campaign, and it underscores just like how crazy everything was with how things ended with her.
You know, something that was raised to me, again, sort of a background conversation trying to make sense of this, is that state investigations rules, there's timing issues when it comes to a candidate for an election. And so the question is sort of, does she still count as an active candidate, even though she's no longer running because she's on the ballot? And so will we see some of these investigations perhaps launch after the primary? So we shall see. Before we wrap up the show, we want to once again plug some of the interviews that you did with candidates for people who are trying to make up their minds in this final weekend.
Well, thanks. Hey, yeah, watching Wisconsin was politics. It was great to do. I hope to be able to do it again.
Great. Well, that will do it for us. We will see everyone on the other side of the primary. I am Anya Van Wagtendonk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrell Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.